This month's podcast features Lou Finfer, a legendary Boston community organizer since 1970. After volunteering in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, Lou began working for neighborhood improvement groups in Dorchester in the 1970s. In the 1980s, he directed the Massachusetts Tenants Organization and then the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance. He served as director of the Massachusetts Communities Action Network, known as MCAN, from 1985 until 2021. In this podcast, you'll hear how using one-on-one outreach is the best way to organize people.
You have to do a lot of listening and outreach for any kind of issue you work on. You know, you may have existing members of your own organization. Sometimes I've had, you may be in coalitions, but you have to do a lot of listening and outreach.
How keeping those relationships is essential to a cause.
You know, what's something they've been involved in that they're proud of, and you need to say something like that too. If you ask people what are they upset about or worried about, and why, you need to sometimes share how you would answer that question so they know what you're talking about as well as they trust that this is a conversation, not just squeezing them for information.
And how Judge Arthur Garrity's order to integrate the Boston Public Schools had some positive attributes that still exist today.
Part of the court order was to set up racial ethnic parent councils in every school, and that was the first time that they were real groups, and let alone they were integrated. Garrity also set hiring goals for hiring teachers of color and principals of color, and the exam schools. He ordered them to be one-third students of color. So there were a number of positive things that he ordered that helped change the system.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of blended learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by recovering learning loss and reaching and maintaining grade-level skills. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. In an article published last year in the Boston Globe, Lou Finfer was described as a quiet leader who spent the past four decades orchestrating some of Boston's biggest campaigns for social and economic justice. In a recent conversation with JFY's executive director, Gary Kaplan, they reflected on Lou's unique ability to push for social change while remaining largely behind the scenes.
Thank you for giving us the time, Lou. I was just saying a few minutes ago, last time I saw you was at your farewell from MCAN. So you retired from MCAN, but you're not exactly sitting back and smoking your pipe, are you?
Yeah, no, I've continued with a few projects I was doing at MCAN, and then this Boston Desegregation and Busing Initiative and a few other things. So I'm not that retired yet.
How did this come about? Is this an actual organization, this Boston Desegregation and Busing Initiative?
It's not incorporated, but we have a committee of 40 people that's guiding it. And it's made up of people who were community leaders going back to the 70s and earlier, like UB Jones. It includes five or six teachers who taught back in the 70s. It includes some people who we call them the kids on the bus, who were bused, but they're in their 50s and 60s. That includes Michael Curry from the NAACP and Kim Janey, the former mayor. So we have a committee guiding it. Carolyn Crockett and I are co-chairs. Carolyn's teaches at MIT. She was chief of equity under Mayor Walsh, and she wrote a book about the campaign to stop the 10-lane highway. And her mother, and very notably, additionally, her grandmother was one of the 15 adult plaintiffs in the Tallulah Morgan versus James Hennigan case that Judge Garrity ruled on.
Her grandmother was one of the plaintiffs.
Yeah, there are 15 adult plaintiffs and 43 children are the actual plaintiffs in the court case called Tallulah Morgan versus James Hennigan.
Boy, that kind of compresses the time frame, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, the oral history that you recorded with Suffolk University in 2005, I listened to it, and it sounds as if it was recorded yesterday. Mm-hmm. As far as the issues are concerned.
Yes.
You use a very a very nice phrase in that in that recording. You talked about the quote poignant irony, unquote,
yes,
of the divergence of views between the white working class folks who in South Boston and other parts of the town, and the black people in who were involved in the same thing. One side looking at the whole thing as busing, the other side looking at it as desegregation.
Yep.
And then you talked about the divergence of the divergence of views within the Democratic Party as it began to split into sort of elite suburban liberals and white working class people who began to drift to the Republican Party.
Well, some of them, the majority of work, I think white working class people still vote Democrat, but it's a very close that, you know, it used to be probably 2/3 or 3/4, and now it's probably 50-50. So, and the same thing with college educated, used to be predominantly Republican, and now it's more in the Democratic condition. So it definitely is huge switch of people, but it's not 100% switch.
And then you have the whole culture war phenomenon now, which, as you said back then, was beginning over Vietnam, over race, over certain cultural issues. But as other issues crept into it, like gay rights, abortion, and other issues that really weren't talked about in 1960, 67 and 68, but have been talked about much more in recent years, the cultural split has gotten even more aggravated. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes. I mean, the caricature of the cultural charges back then was that liberals were for acid, amnesty, and what was the third one?
Abortion.
Abortion, no. Yes.
Was it yeah. Abortion?
Yes, acid, amnesty, and abortion. That was the stereotype or the charge used against liberals. Yes.
So tell me, Lou, here you are, 23, 24 years old, and you were kind of just out of Harvard.
I was working in Dorchester. I started working in Dorchester volunteering in 1970 and then full time since 72. And I've lived there since 71. So I was a young community organizer in a group, and we it was very challenging trying to keep together. We were one of the probably largest integrated community organizations in the city at that point, because the neighborhoods were so undiverse. And being in Dorchester, you had a chance at least to organize across racial lines if you did it across all of Dorchester, which we did. But it was very, you know, it was a very tense and divisive time. We were able to keep our members together, working on a lot of other common issues like blockbusting and redlining and overassessment on taxes and abandoned buildings and so forth. But we weren't able to find something on education to work on together. And you couldn't, you know, I was only 23, so I didn't, 24, I didn't, you know a lot. And also you can't invite a judge to a meeting. You can invite Mayor White and maybe he'll send someone, and you know, maybe sometimes you get him, but you can't invite a judge to the meeting. So it wasn't, you know, other than through once it got to that stage, other than through, you know, being a plaintiff or something, you can't get to the judge.
How did you start out? You know, you're a kid, you're just out of college, you're not even from Boston, and here you are in Dorchester. How did you get started?
Well, I started volunteering in September of 70 when I was still in college. Somewhat, I was actually supposed to work for this group called the Dorchester Tenants Action Council that summer before that. But I also had an opportunity to work in a community group in Columbus, Ohio, and I'd never been outside of the East. So I chose to do that. But then when I got back in September, the person I had gotten to take my place in the Dorchester group said it was going well and they could use other volunteers. So I started volunteering September of 1970 and volunteered for my last 2 years of college. And I lived in Dorchester my senior year in college. And then I became a full-time staff person for the group in June of 1972. So I had
And what was the group called?
Well, it was, first it was called Dorchester Tenants Action Council, but we actually changed the name in 1974 to Dorchester Community Action Council because we were broadening to work on community issues that affected home, you know, owner-occupied homeowners and their tenants, whereas the tenants' rights affected tenants of absentee landlords, which was about 20% of the people. But by changing our name, we were embracing an agenda that included, you know, all the different people's issues in Dorchester. So it was Dorchester Community Action Council in by, you know, by 1974 when busing and desegregation started.
Lou, who are some of the other people that were involved at that time?
You mean who were the names?
I mean, this is the White administration, right?
Well, I mean, we were a community nonprofit, but it was during the White administration. Sure. That's
yeah. Kevin was elected in 68.
And we were dealing with the, you know, some of his staff. Kirk O'Donnell was the director of the Office of Public Service that ran what were called the Little City Halls.
Oh, and, yes.
Frank Jens was the Housing Inspection Commissioner, and John Grace was the director of the Rent Control Board. Those were some of the Ira Jackson was his.
Ira.
Was chief of staff, and I was on this committee for the Boston Desegregation Busing Initiative. I was on it, but he was Kevin White's chief of staff in 74, 75. And then we had a slew of community residents who were the leaders and officers and steering committee of our organization back then.
And when did MCAM happen?
MCAM.
Did it grow directly out of that?
Not really. In the Dorchester group, I worked for also then in late at the end of 75 we became part of a statewide group called Massachusetts Fair Share.
Oh yeah,
statewide group, and we became the Dorchester chapter of Mass Fair Share, and we were the largest largest chapter. So that Fair Share, I left to work in a group in Somerville in 1978, and then I worked for Massachusetts Tenants Organization from 80 to 85 and Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance from 85 to 91. But we started a group in 1985 called the Organizing and Leadership Training Center, which was giving training and technical assistance to community groups. And the one group we started back then was called Mass Affordable Housing Alliance. And then we started creating groups across the state. There were generally coalitions of religious congregations that worked on community improvement issues. And over those years, we formed groups and that still exist and a part of this, the MCAN network, Mass Communities Action Network. Mm-hmm. We have local groups, affiliates in Springfield, Worcester, Brockton, Fall River, New Bedford, Lynn, and Boston. So MCAN grew out, OLTC changed its name to MCAN about 2006 or 8.
So you have been doing community organizing, social action. You can't do social action without organizing people. One of the things that you get praised for a lot is your ability to bring people together, to organize people with a very diverse people. How do you do that? And how are you able to cover such a wide range of individuals, bringing them together? Is it, you know, you call them up and they say, "Oh, sure, Lou, whatever you say, I'll be there." Is that how it works?
Not that easy. You have to do a lot of listening and outreach for any kind of issue you work on. You know, you may have existing members of your own organization. Sometimes I've had, we may be in coalitions, but you have to do a lot of listening and outreach. And especially we try to use something we call a one-to-one relational meeting, where when I first got into organizing, the way you did outreach is you basically said, you know, knocked on someone's door and said, "We're working on this. Are you interested? Or what are you concerned about? What are you upset about?" Which is fine, but you're not dealing with the person. You're almost like taking a survey. And then sometimes it leads to a conversation that's more about in depth, but it's about the issues. The difference is in what we call a one-to-one relational meeting, and I can send you something on this at some point, but a one-to-one relational meeting is usually a half-hour meeting, a face-to-face meeting, and you're exploring some background of people, their story, of you know some of the story of their life. How did they get to their job? How do they get to where they're living? What have they been involved in that they're proud of? And then you do ask, what are they concerned about? But then you follow up by asking why and asking if there's a story behind whatever they named is an important concern, because you're trying to get further into their story and background and interests. And really, you're trying to see their capacity for leadership. And at the same time in those conversations, you have to share some of your story. It can't just be a one-way conversation if you expect people to trust you and, you know, give of themselves. So that's the key, these kinds of what we call one-to-one relational meetings, because then you get to know someone in a better way and what motivates, when you use the phrase, what makes them tick, and not just take a survey that this guy or this woman cares about education or housing, but you want to know the story behind it, as well as the story, some of their story. Because in some of these meetings, you're looking for people that you'd want to work with. So you want to know some of the things they've been involved in and what they feel proud of and so forth. So that's the key. And then it's just listening. And then it's preparing for meetings. And, you know, when you speak to people before planning meetings about what's coming up and how do they feel about it. And you speak to people after meetings about how do they evaluate the meeting? How do they feel it went? You have to do that kind of work to be effective over time. And then also it's helpful to be up on the what's going on politically. There's three different news compendiums now published in Massachusetts: Political Mass and Master List, and that are like daily news compendiums that you can read. You can skim them. Each one takes about 5 to 10 minutes. But those are so keep you up on the issues of the day. And they also furnish things to ask people about in conversations. But we do a power analysis. We do an extensive power analysis of different political and business and labor and media and institutional figures and organizations. So we also do an extensive power analysis to try to be up on what's going on and who's who and what's what.
Who's we?
Well, that's something I do and our organization does. We print it up, and we constantly are revising it because, every week there's something that's new about someone who did this, or we have to replace it. We had a whole section on Governor Baker, and that goes to the bottom. And then we have now a whole new section on Maura Healey and her advisors and some of her background. So you have to, with the political figures, you have to revise it periodically as they change office.
The organization that you're talking about, is it now this desegregation and busing initiative?
No, our organization is now called Massachusetts Action for Justice. And it's just a new nonprofit that I set up in January. But, it's following up from all the work I did at MCAN for many
years. So you set up a new organization. Is it a 501c3?
Not yet.
But you're going to go for that.
Yeah. We have a...
So you retire from one and you turn right around and found another one.
Yep.
Yeah, you just can't stop, can you?
It's things that are interesting that I want to work with people on.
So you started all of this kind of work in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, let's see if my math is correct, that's 53 years.
Yep.
That you've been doing this, involved with issues, talking to people. The one-to-one relational meetings, that you're still doing that?
Yes, the concept of one-to-one relational meetings came out of community organizing in the 1970s as a deeper way to, have conversations and outreach with people.
It takes a long time to have a meeting like that, right?
Yeah, but it's sort of like we try to get organizers to make that the center of their agenda. The goal is that people who are in organizations is to do, 10 or more of these a week. Sometimes
10 a week?
Yeah, sometimes people are doing 15 to 20.
A week?
Because it pushes the whole organization forward, because some of them are with people who are potentially could get involved. So you're meeting people and then you're deciding about inviting them to get involved. Sometimes doing ones with people who already are involved about next steps in planning some issue you're working on. And sometimes you do it with policy people or potential allies. And, you know, so you, it's the, we coach organizers that that should be the central part of their work. And we ask them to do weekly reports. But the first thing on the weekly report is, who did you do one-to-ones with? And then who did meetings that you went to is second. But for the first thing we ask them is to report on who they did one-to-ones with, so we know what they're doing and how many they did. Because you can be busy and spend 40, 50 plus hours, you know, going to a lot of meetings and sending emails and doing research, which is all fine. But if you're not sitting down with people individually, you're not helping develop more involved leaders and people, and you're not moving your agenda very well if you're not doing that as the central thing.
How do you get these meetings? You call some, you email somebody and say, I want to come over and talk to you for an hour?
Call them, and usually there's a credential. We call it a credential. Usually there's a basis that
there's
I'm
a what? A what?
A credential.
Yeah.
That you have. Either I got your name from such and such.
Yeah.
You're working on such and such, and I wanted to talk to you because I thought you were interested or were involved in something like that. So you create a, you give a basis about your legitimacy to talk to them is what you have to do when you're setting up the meeting.
Do you ever have people say, no, I'm not interested? I don't have time.
Occasionally, but not that often.
Not that often, really.
But, you know, you're trying to pursue people. And usually because you have some type of a credential, either a person that they know or some basis that you know their organization or institution or what they're working on is something you've been working on. So you have some something that's credible to talk to them about. But you have to, you know, like, that's why in the meeting you have to also share something about yourself, about what you're, you know, like if you ask people what's something they've been involved in that they're proud of, then you need to say something like that too. If you ask people what are they upset about or worried about, and why, you need to sometimes share how you would answer that question so they know what you're talking about as well as they trust that this is a conversation, not just squeezing them for information.
Do you record these meetings?
No.
No.
No. And you can't, you don't take notes either. And I'm the biggest note taker in the Western Hemisphere, so it was really hard for me. But after the meeting is finished, we do urge people to write down some notes about the key things they learned about the person.
How long do these meetings last?
30 to 40 minutes. It's not like, and you know, some of the people, as they get involved, you're going to do additional one-to-ones with them as you move forward with things you're working on together. And sometimes it's just a one-time thing because not everyone you meet with, there's a need to meet again. Or sometimes someone might be interesting or not, or they may be really, their lives may be really full, so they don't really want to do anything else. So, you know, you just have to evaluate, you know, after the meeting. But you do write down some notes to help you remember a sense of what the person was like, a sense of what they said about their concerns. I try to remember to, I try to write a quote of what they said. Sometimes that helps me reimagine the meeting as it was taking place. Because even though you say, oh yeah, I remember that meeting. I had that meeting with Gary yesterday. After half an hour, you remember less and less of the meeting. So it's important to try to take some notes afterwards.
But you don't take notes during the meeting.
No, because then people think you're kind of, you know, who's going to get this information, and you're kind of putting yourself in a, like a social worker or professional, you know, position versus them. You want to have a conversation.
But they know you're a social worker and a professional.
Yeah, but you're having a conversation, but also you're sharing some of your story. It's not just a one-way conversation, and that helps create some understanding of what you're trying to talk about, but also some trust.
Trust, yeah. Lou, how many of these have you done?
Oh, there's no way
to count. Since 1970.
There's no way to count, you know. There's not a way to count. But it is something, mostly started doing it in 1990 because it's a practice of what we call faith-based community organizing, which is a slice of community organizing is done through coalitions of religious congregations. So a lot of the work I've done since 1990 is with those types of groups. but they're all other community organizations that are organized around one neighborhood or one issue and so forth. But the practice of one-on-one relational meetings was more developed through faith-based community organizations.
How did you get into that? You didn't go to divinity school, did you?
No. But the development of community organizing, and the first community faith-based organization was in 1975 in San Antonio, Texas. And then in through the 80s, more of those were developed, and there were some meetings that I got to go to with some of those groups, you know, in the 1985 that were working on the East Coast. And I saw that, I felt those groups were more powerful because they had more people involved. They had people going to training for 5 to 7 days. So we shifted completely in 1990 to doing that kind of faith-based organizing. Previous 20 years, I had worked on what I would call issue organizing that was done at a neighborhood level or a state level, but it was around issues. And people belong generally as individual people or organizations. So it was a switch in 1990 to do what was called faith-based community organizing.
So this was a deliberate switch on your part.
Yes.
Are you involved in that with any church or synagogue or whatever?
I'm Jewish. I belong to a temple, Temple Shalom in Milton. I live in Dorchester, but there's no synagogues anymore in Dorchester. I've written about that, and I give tours about the history of
Blue Hill Avenue,
why the Jewish community left between 1968 and 1972 because of blockbusting and redlining.
Do you do the Blue Hill Avenue tour?
I do the tour. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But I worked in these faith-based organizations, which are predominantly Christian.
Yeah.
But there's some Jewish and Muslim members of these kinds of groups. But I'm teaching a course at Harvard Divinity School on faith-based community organizing.
How big a movement is this, faith-based organizing?
Oh, there's probably 150, 200 organizations across this country that are doing that kind of organizing. There are four what we call national networks. There are four different organizations with somewhat different histories, but they're using what would be people would call faith-based community organizing. So we belong to one of them, which is called Faith in Action. The others are called the Industrial Areas Foundation.
Saul Alinsky.
And that's his original group. There's still a very strong network. And then there's one called the Gamaliel Foundation, which is, they're not foundations. It's just the name, called Direct Action Research and Training. So there are four of these national networks of faith-based organizations. And then there are other networks of groups that are organized on an issue basis or neighborhood basis, but not based on religious congregation. So there are other community organizing networks that are not faith-based as well.
Was Alinsky an important influence for you?
Sure. I heard him speak. I went to a conference at his training center that he spoke at in 1969. I mean, he's the, you know, the modern founder of community organizing. And then a lot of the civil rights movement in and of itself is community organizing. So that wasn't organized by Alinsky, though some of Alinsky's groups in the North in the 60s, the Fight Organization, the Rochester, the Woodlawn Organization, Chicago, those are considered Northern civil rights organizations, but they were organized in affiliation with Alinsky and the Industrial Areas Foundation. So yeah, he's the modern founder of community organizing, a lot of the concepts. And then he died in 1972. So a lot of people have carried forward both in his organization and other organizations to further develop the field. Though he had religious congregations involved in you know, some of the groups he organized, it was really, implemented in a deeper way by his successors after he died in 1972. But you know, the Industrial Areas Foundation was the first one to develop faith-based organizing in this modern period in the 70s and 80s. And then these three other networks formed in the, you know, in the 80s and so forth.
And you consider yourself part of that movement now, faith-based?
Sure, we're still affiliated with the one of the four networks, which is called Faith in Action. It used to be called PICO, but it's now called Faith in Action.
Starting back in 1973 and 74, when the shakeup of the Boston Public Schools started, and then jumping to today and to last week, and what you're doing now, which according to the Globe says that your future events are going to provoke discussion on how the Boston Public Schools can improve quality and equity in education for all Boston students.
Yes.
Well,
small.
How's that going? Yeah.
Small,
yeah.
Small agenda.
Yeah. Really. Should be able to knock that off in a couple hours. Are we better off now than we were in 1974 or five or six?
Yes, I think we are, even with the trauma that. Real trauma that took place in those years. But part of the court order was to set up racial ethnic parent councils in every school. And that was the first time that there were real parent groups, and let alone they were integrated. Garrity also set hiring goals for hiring teachers of color and principals of color and the exam schools. He ordered them to be one third students of color. So there were a number of positive things that he ordered that helped change the system. And not some of that would have happened, but not as dramatically without those court orders that were made, between 74 and 1980. Obviously, there's a lot of controversy over the busing plan and how he did it and how it could have been done differently. And there's a lot of controversies over that. Today, in some ways, we're still living with that, because if you're a parent in the Boston Public Schools, you can choose from anywhere from 10 to 12 elementary schools in the larger section of the city you live in. So they're not neighborhood schools. There still are not neighborhood schools in Boston like there still are in the suburbs. And it's a loss. It's a loss, too. I mean, the schools were consciously segregated by actions of the school committee, which was documented in their own minutes. This decision was the right one. But there's a cost that, when there's not a neighborhood schools, then the kids don't from a neighborhood don't have as many ways to meet each other. Parents don't have as many ways to meet each other, and the schools are not seen as institutions of the community. You pass by them. The Taylor School is six blocks from here, but you just go by it. The kids from the neighborhood, that only a smaller number go to it. So it's there's a cost to it too.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, you said back in 2005 that you thought it might have been better to pursue desegregation incrementally in steps rather than all at once, mm-hmm. as Garrity did.
Yes.
Do you still think that?
I think there's a case for it. I'd want to hear other people's opinions and educators' opinion, but there's a case if they'd started it, say, with the elementary schools or the elementary and middle schools. Most of the biggest conflict and violence and so forth happened in high schools. It's not like there wouldn't have been similar levels of opposition if there was just busing and desegregation of the elementary schools, but the kids didn't beat each other, get into, those kinds of things in those schools. So there's a case for that, but also a large majority of schools did open peaceably, even though there were significant places where they did not. So, but I think there's a case for incremental, it was done partially. Garrity, I think he grandfathered in seniors in high school to their current high school. So even he did some kinds of flexible things like that in his own court order. But I think there's a case for, obviously there are a lot of people would have liked it to be a metropolitan-wide order, so that it was, that there was shared across the whole region this process, and it would have brought more money and motivated parents into it. But there, unfortunately, there was a Supreme Court case, if you can believe it, 1 month after Garrity's ruling in June of 74, there was a Supreme Court ruling called the Bradley decision, the Milliken decision, Milliken versus Bradley in Detroit.
Yeah.
That desegregation and busing could only be done within a municipality. It wasn't metropolitan wide.
That's right.
And that was a 5-4 decision. And then Garrity, you know, had to be mindful of that.
That was Rehnquist, I think. Yes. I think it was Rehnquist wrote the decision.
Yes. Yes.
And the famous phrase from that decision, he says something like, nothing is more sacred in America than local control of schools. Right. And that was it. That's why, you know, you can't even, there's no point even talking about, metropolitan area or anything outside the city limits. It's unconstitutional, according to that decision.
And President Nixon had 2 or 3 appointees when he was president, and that changed the court. And that's why it was 5-4. The same case under, you know, if it was in the, during the Johnson administration, would have been 5-4 or 6-3 the other way.
Yeah. And now, of course, it would be 6-3 the same way.
Yes. Yes.
Interesting. Do you think this is kind of a tangent, but do you think it will ever be possible to cross municipal boundaries with the schools?
Probably not, based on the traditions we have. I think you could perhaps set up some magnet schools. You could fund some magnet schools in the metropolitan area, but not. I don't think there's the political will or interest in doing that. And there's such a long tradition of the individual, you know, school committees and individual and so forth. So I don't think it would happen.
So looking at today, at right now, what do you think can be done right now to improve quality and equity in the Boston Public Schools?
I mean, we're trying to figure out our role in that question. We did come up with 3 proposals on education, which we've met with Mayor Wu about, and we're going to meet with Superintendent Skipper about, and we're looking at a 4th one. But we're also going to be trying to do next year, during the process of our forums, more find ways to listen more and research more to come up with other proposals for the schools. So we kind of see our 3 questions that we're trying to answer with our work over the next 2 years are what happened and lessons learned from the past, and what now. And
those are your 3 questions: what happened, lessons learned,
and what now.
And what now?
So we have come up with a few proposals on education. We've started to bring forward, and we may look to develop further ones. There are obviously lots of things out there that seem compelling, you know, the globe, you know, the thing about, you know, learning loss and tutoring and individual learning plans. And you, Gary, you know more about education policies that work, and you've made them work than I do, but those are some of the things we're talking about.
Well, what are your, you say you got, you've had three concrete proposals?
The two are about aspects of teacher training.
What are they?
You know, teacher training policies and
learning.
And one is about creating partnerships where we asking a major institution, a hospital or a major corporation, take on one grade of the Boston Public Schools and create a in-depth partnership of experiences and funding. So those are the 3 we have. And then we're researching one about funding, because Boston is going to have their own funding problems, because they, the federal ESSER money is, you know, going to run out in the next year. And the Chapter 70 money, there's been a major increase, you know, because of the Student Opportunity Act. But that's really the gateway cities who are benefiting significantly. Boston's, the Chapter 70 formula, Boston doesn't do that well on, because Boston is still
too big. It's too big.
It's also has all these downtown buildings that we're not property tax poor, like New Bedford is, and all the gateway cities are. So the amounts of increase in Chapter 70 money that Boston is getting is very, very small, versus the gateway cities are getting significant increases. So we have some ideas on how Boston might try to change that, particularly with the state legislature too, that we're researching. But we're also going to be listening and talking to different policy groups, including yourself, you know, to try to come up with, an agenda to support. We haven't figured out whether we're going to, beyond the four things we came up with, are we going to continue to develop an agenda, or are we going to try to learn more, but also connect people to existing groups who are doing, work. There are, other groups, the Ed Vesters and the Boston Education Justice Coalition. There's a number of organizations that are, trying to work currently to change the schools as well.
The tax relief package that just passed is going to decrease state revenues. The millionaire's tax is bringing in some additional state revenues, but I think the tax relief plan is going to take more out of the state revenues than the millionaire's tax is going to put back in. So then all the federal pandemic money is going to be gone, and we might be kind of tiptoeing into a recession, but we certainly have a lot of downtown real estate problems in the state because all the office buildings are empty. Do you see a crunch in state funding on the horizon?
Could be. I think the millionaire's tax is still going to bring in more than is being lost through the tax relief package, but not enough more. I think there is the commitment on the Student Opportunity Act to make increases for 7 years of $300 million in Chapter 70 local aid. And I think we're in year three of that 7 year commitment. It doesn't mean if the economy went into severe recession, then they would politically think they can't meet that commitment. But if we don't go into recession, that's a major commitment they made to fund those increases each year. But then, it's never enough money. And then Boston, as I said, Boston gets very little, that $300 million, just because the formula is not in their direction. On the other hand, Boston, because has more money, they can put in city money in a way that no other city can put in as much money as Boston does, because they don't have the tax revenue.
Yeah.
But it's still overall not good or fair for Boston to not do well under Chapter 70 as it is.
Lou, it seems like we've kind of known each other forever, and we're still having the same conversation, and it's still the same issues.
To me, it's more the glass is half full.
Yeah.
There are some infinite positive things and more opportunity also racially than there was, but it's only half full. So there's a lot to do.
So Lou, thank you.
Oh, thanks. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
We would like to thank Lou Finfer for joining us this month for the JFY Networks podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free educational resources, including these monthly podcasts, to support all education communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.